Okay, so we're in Ruth chapter 2 this morning. Just to remind you, if you weren't with us last week, we started a new little four-week series in the beautiful ancient book of Ruth, which you can find in your Old Testament after the book of Judges. And really the kind of subtitle of this series is a line from a song called Waymaker, which says, "Even when I don't see it, you're working." And we've already had a flavor of that expressed in our worship this morning, because really Ruth is a book all about the goodness of God, even in the midst of challenges and very real sorrow and suffering. And yet God is always there, working in the unseen, working in the background, working through human actions, through circumstances to bring about his will. So quick reminder of what we looked at last week, if you weren't with us in Ruth chapter 1. Now, I got rebuked after last week's sermon by Louise Larkin for anglicizing Elimelech's name. Lou, as you know, has strong Jewish roots and well-versed in the Hebrew Old Testament. So how should I pronounce Elimelech? Elimelech. There you go. Very different from what I said. So we started off with this guy Elimelech or Elimelech, and he. I'm going to say Elimelech just to annoy you, actually. And so he uprooted his family, his wife Naomi, and his two sons Mahlon and Chilion. They were living in Bethlehem, but there was famine in the land, happening in the time of the Judges, where really Israel weren't going after God in faithfulness to the covenant that they had with him. And so they moved to this place called Moab, this foreign nation, in the hope that life would be more prosperous there. But things didn't really work out the way Elimelech had hoped. He ended up dying, and then his two sons died about kind of 10 years after he did, leaving Naomi on her own with her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. And so Naomi makes this decision to return back to Bethlehem, and understandably, she is of heaviness of heart. She describes herself as being left empty by the things that have happened to her, and she says to her two daughters-in-law, "Stay, you know, don't come with me to Bethlehem. There's not going to be anything for you there. You're going to be foreigners and outsiders. Go back to your family homes. There's the prospect of you marrying again, and you know, being with your family and being in the culture that you grew up in." And so Orpah agrees, and she goes back, but Ruth clings to Naomi. And we saw how through Ruth's devotion to Naomi, we saw the Lord's devotion to Naomi, even though she couldn't see it at the time. And so chapter 1 ends with both Naomi and Ruth back in Bethlehem. Now, last week we had one word that we were remembering to describe God's commitment to Naomi, mainly through Ruth's actions and also his commitment to us. Who can remember what that word was? It was remain. Well done, Lucy. That gives me such a warm glow in my heart. It was the word remain. We talked about how God remains with us. He is committed to us in every situation. And the word that I want you to remember this week also begins with R, okay? And it's the word refuge. So last week it was the word remain, and it was the word refuge. And so kids, if you want to do something during this talk, you might want to write the word refuge, or get your mum and daddy to write the word refuge on a big piece of paper, and you could colour that in or draw some pictures in terms of what I'm describing as we go along, and maybe we could see those at the end. So this week we're looking at the word refuge, and we're going to see all the ways that God provides for, all the ways that God looks after Ruth and Naomi. So as we get to the beginning of chapter 2, as I said, Naomi and Ruth are back in Bethlehem, but that hasn't solved, well, anything, really. The situation is still very difficult for them, and we know it's difficult because the first thing that we read about in chapter 2 is that Ruth suggests to Naomi that she go and glean grain in a field. Now, anybody ever been gleaning in a field? Anybody know what gleaning is? Yeah, we've got a few people who know what gleaning is. You know what gleaning is, amazing. So gleaning basically was a provision under the Old Testament law where owners of fields were instructed not to harvest to the corners or to the edges of their fields, so that poor people could come and they could collect the grain from the kind of edges, and also not to collect all of their grain after they've reaped, but again to leave some so that people could follow after the reapers and glean that for themselves. So it was provision for poor people. So by the very fact that Ruth says, "Why don't I go and find a field and glean," shows us that actually Ruth and Naomi, even though they've returned to Bethlehem, are not in a good way. There are two things that we see. The first is that they are very poor. Yeah, they have no land of their own to harvest. And so Ruth's going to go and glean in order that they can eat and survive. So their situation, even though they've returned, hasn't taken this sudden upturn. They're still in a really difficult situation, a really desperate position. But secondly, what this shows us is just God's heart. Way back at the start, when he was setting out the law for the poor, that actually God put this provision within the law so that people like Ruth and Naomi would be able to get food so that they wouldn't starve. So even before we think about the specifics of God's heart towards Ruth and Naomi, we see the specifics of God's heart towards his people in general, that actually there's this provision for the poor in that they can go and glean in fields if they have no fields of their own. And then it says this in verse 3. It says, so she, that's Ruth, set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Now, it's really interesting the way that the writer describes Ruth finding herself in Boaz's field. She just happened to be there. Okay, so does the writer think that's just a coincidence? Well, no, I think the writer's being ironic. The writer's writing after this whole story's happened. He knows how significant this story is in terms of Israel's history. Okay, and he's writing from a perspective that Ruth doesn't yet see at this point. So from Ruth's point of view, she just happens to go to Boaz's field. And yet actually, God is bringing her, leading her to Boaz's field. So this is not about coincidence. This is about God's providence. And God is working all the way in this time. I'm sure that many of us could have stories of God's providence working through what seems like just coincidence, yeah, or circumstance. But actually, it's God, the sovereign Lord, who reigns over all things, just working through human decisions, working through situations. So we had a situation even just this week, something that we were specifically praying about. I won't go into the details. And then by coincidence, two people, one phoned us, one messaged us, an answer to that prayer. Now, had they been praying about that thing? Maybe they had, I don't know. But even just through their decision to want to reach out to us, that was God providing for us. And so often we miss it when those kind of things happen, or we just kind of sideline it as coincidence, and yet it's God providentially working for our benefit. And so that's what's happening in this situation. Ruth doesn't yet see it. She doesn't know what's happened, but she's led to go to this field. She just happens to go to this field. And what we're going to see in the rest of the chapter is God's kindness and provision working through human action and circumstance. And so straight after verse 3, we have verse 4, and it says, and behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. That's a great way to be introduced into any story. And behold, Boaz came. I'd love to have that. If someone was writing my kind of, you know, autobiography, they wouldn't write my biography. It'd be like, and behold, Jeff arrived in Whitstable. You know, it's just a great way. You know, it kind of says, here's an important thing, right? Here's an important moment. Boaz is arriving on the scene, and Boaz is our romantic hero of the story. You know, if you like Pride and Prejudice, you know, Boaz is kind of your Mr. Darcy, you know, kind of figure. He's the one. Well, actually, you know, he kind of is, but again, a bit of the way that Mr. Darcy is, he's a bit misunderstood. Boaz is quite old. He's older than Ruth. Okay, so it wouldn't necessarily be Boaz is the one that all the ladies are swooning over. But from our point of view and from what happens in the story, Boaz is the romantic hero of the story. And at the start of chapter 2, it tells us that Boaz is a relative of Elimelech's, and also that he's a worthy man. And this is really good news for two reasons. Okay, the first reason is that Boaz arrives on the scene, Ruth is in Boaz's field, and Boaz is a good guy. He's a godly guy. Yeah, God has brought Ruth to a godly guy. And you've got to remember, this is a time in Israel's history where actually there probably weren't that many godly, worthy men around. The nation had turned their backs on Israel's God and were worshipping other gods. And yet God brings Ruth to the field of a godly, righteous man in Boaz. A man who has stuck it out, actually, throughout the famine. He's still there. Remember the famine that started, the reason Elimelech left? Boaz didn't leave. He showed his trust in God's faithfulness and his provision. And we're going to see his godliness worked out in a lot of ways. So it's good news that Boaz is a good guy. Secondly, it's good news, though, because he's a relative of Elimelech. And so anybody reading this story with any kind of understanding of Old Testament law will know that therefore that means Boaz is what's described as a kinsman redeemer. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of that because Keith's going to preach in a couple of weeks about what a kinsman redeemer is. He's looking excited about that. But in short, it basically meant that Boaz, as a relative of Elimelech, okay, was in a position where he could buy the land that Elimelech owned, and he could take Ruth as his wife, and he could provide an heir for her and for Naomi and carry on the family name. So knowing that this is Boaz's field, and knowing that Boaz is a relative of Elimelech, as you're reading it, you might think, oh, there's some hope here. There's an opportunity. There could be a future here for Ruth and for Naomi. And so there's one guy, well, there's one other who comes later, but this guy who could provide a future for Ruth and Naomi, she just happens to go to his field. And then he just happens to turn up at that field and behold Boaz. Yeah, which might not seem like a big deal, but actually Boaz would have had servants. He would have had an overseer at the field. He wouldn't have needed to go down and get his hands dirty to reap the harvest for himself. And yet he goes and he is there. And even more importantly than that, he notices her. He sees her gleaning in the corner of the field. And this would be the moment in the kind of, you know, romantic Pride and Prejudice thing where he looks over and the camera goes into soft focus, you know, and zooms in on her as she's there first not looking, gleaning away. And then she looks up and her hair flings back as the sun, you know, goes upon her face and the camera goes in and the music kind of swells and it cuts back to Boaz and he's just looking at her. This is the kind of, I think romantic comedies call it the meet cute. That's what it's described. This is the moment that they see each other. But all joking aside, he sees her. He sees her at a time where nobody else was seeing her, where she probably felt invisible to everybody else. She's gleaning in the field, in the corner. She's not been welcomed by anybody else. And yet she is seen by Boaz. And that's a reflection of how in that moment, it's not just Boaz seeing her, it's the Lord seeing her. There's a story in Genesis about Abraham and Hagar, his servant, and she becomes pregnant through Abraham, and yet Sarah becomes really jealous, and she basically says, you've got to get rid of Hagar and her son Ishmael. And yet God lovingly comes and cares and promises provision for Hagar, and Hagar describes the Lord as the Lord who sees me. The Lord who sees me. And that's exactly what's going on here as well. The Lord is seeing Ruth. I just want to encourage you this morning, sometimes in life we can feel like God's not seeing us, like he's looking elsewhere. It seems to be blessing other people. But in this moment, the thing that I'm facing, has the Lord overlooked me? I just want to encourage you this morning that the Lord sees you. He sees you. He sees what nobody else sees. He sees you when you feel like you're invisible. He sees you when you feel like nobody else understands the problems or the trials that you face. He sees you in the same way that Boaz saw Ruth. And so what we see in Boaz's response to Ruth is a reflection of the Lord's heart of provision and protection and care in so many ways. So just very briefly, because we haven't got time to go through all of the story, but here's a few ways that we see the Lord's provision and protection of Ruth through Boaz's action. Firstly, he tells her to stay in his field. Yeah, because he knows that she's going to be safe. She goes to another field. Some of those other field owners maybe aren't as godly or as righteous as Boaz. And so she might not be welcomed or she might not be treated right. So he wants her to stay in his field. He charges his young men, his servants, not to touch her. Okay, so if he's not there, they're to leave her alone. So he puts this kind of authoritative word of protection over her. He tells her when she's thirsty to go and get a drink. At a mealtime, he invites her to come and sit down with everybody else and eat. And again, that's a massive thing. You know, it's this kind of foreign woman being invited to come and have this meal with people from Israel. And then he instructs his servants at the end to let her glean where she wants, not just on the outskirts, not just in the corners. Let her glean wherever she wants. Don't rebuke her for however much she takes. And even he instructs them to pull up bundles of grain and just leave them for her to collect. You see what Boaz is doing there? He is going above and beyond what the law requires him to do. Why is he doing this? Well, we read in verse 10, when Ruth and Boaz have this conversation. It says, then she fell on her face. This is after Boaz has done that stuff, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So Boaz does all of these things for Ruth because this is God's heart for Ruth. That he himself recognizes that everything he has done has actually been the Lord bringing Ruth under his refuge. It's not, I'm bringing you under my refuge. It's actually, no, you've come and the Lord has brought you under his refuge, but through Boaz's works and decisions. And he does this not just because he fancies her. Yeah, he says that he's heard what she's done for Naomi. He's seen the sacrifices that he's made. His heart has been moved because of the devotion that she has shown to Naomi. But I also think that maybe there's another reason that Boaz acts in this way. That maybe there's a reason that's closer to home to explain this kind of extravagant compassion and care that he shows for Ruth. And as we'll come to see in chapter 4 in a couple of weeks, this story is really important in the big story of salvation in the whole Bible. And actually, if you go to Matthew's Gospel and the genealogy of Jesus, yeah, at the beginning of Matthew's Gospel, which talks through some key people from the kind of Old Testament story who are in the line of Jesus, we find something very significant. Just turn there very briefly. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, we read this. So this is in the genealogy, and it says, I won't do all the names, but picking up from maybe verse 4, and Ram, the father of Aminadab, and Aminadab, the father of Nashon, and Nashon, the father of Salmon, and Salmon, the father, or Salmon, not the fish, and Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. Now, why is that significant? Because if you know anything about who Rahab is, yeah, you'll suddenly get a glimpse into why that is significant. Because Rahab was a foreigner herself, living in Jericho, who, when Joshua sent out spies to go and scout out the land, go into Jericho and are taken into the home of Rahab, who's a woman of, questionable character, shall we say. And she hides them. She hides them in her house, and they remember her, so that then when Israel go and they take Jericho, she's protected and she's allowed to live in the land. And it seems that she then married a guy called Salmon, who was a guy from Israel. And we don't quite know whether she was Boaz's mother or grandmother. The genealogy in Matthew sometimes skips generations. But the important thing is that Boaz is a direct descendant of this woman, Rahab, who was a foreigner who was welcomed in to the people of Israel. She was a foreigner who received the mercy of God. The reality is that if that hadn't happened, Boaz wouldn't be here. Boaz is there because this foreign woman was shown compassion and mercy. He has some of that foreign blood running through his veins. He knows firsthand about the God who provides refuge. And so having benefited, having seen the benefits in his own family, he then shows that same compassion to an outsider. Having known the story, either from his mother or from his grandmother, of how she received mercy, she was brought in to the people, he shows the same care for Ruth. And so what about us? What does this story mean to us this morning? Well, Boaz is a type of Jesus. He's a foreshadower of Jesus in many ways. You see, as God has provided a refuge to Ruth through Boaz, God has provided refuge for us through Christ, an even greater refuge than that which Boaz provided for Ruth. What does this mean? Well, it means that we were outsiders brought under his wing through the cross. Colossians 3:3 says, "For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God." As we were praying before the service, Brian was sharing from Mark and a verse where it talks about Jesus not being able to be hidden. And he was encouraging us with this beautiful truth that Jesus can't be hidden by anything. You know, by circumstance, by situation, Jesus is not hidden. And alongside that, just as Jesus is not hidden from us, we are hidden in him. He is our refuge. He is our hiding place. We were outsiders. We were brought inside. We were brought under his wing. We were in sin. We were brought under his righteousness. We were in rebellion. We were brought into his acceptance. We were, if you know anything about some of the stories in the gospel, we were unworthy even to eat the scraps from his table. And yet he invites us to come and sit and feast with him. Like Boaz to Ruth, Jesus notices us. While we were still sinners, he noticed us and went to us and rescued us in our affliction. Jesus satisfies our thirst by providing the water of life to us. And Jesus abundantly provides for all of our needs, more than we can ask or imagine. At the end of the chapter, we see that Naomi is able to recognize God's kindness in everything that has happened. It says in verse 20, "And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, 'May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead.'" Now that's quite a shift already from where Naomi was just at the end of chapter 1. "I've been left totally empty by the Lord." And now it's like, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." She realized in that moment, God's kindness has not forsaken us. He is bringing us afresh under his refuge. She starts to see it again. And I wonder if there's any of us here this morning who need to see afresh the refuge that has been given to us in Christ, the hiding place that we have, the provision that we have, the care and love and grace that Jesus has shown to us. Are we aware of it? Do we see it? Do we believe that God sees us? Do we see God working in our day-to-day through the big and the small? And do we run to him as our refuge, as our hiding place? Or do we look to hide and cover ourselves with other things that actually aren't able to protect, aren't able to provide? No, we're invited afresh this morning to run to him as our refuge.